I don't think so. Seems like linguistic shenanigans to me. So anyway, English has a nice long word for nice long words like these. Sesquipedalian, our next target word. Sesquipedalian is an adjective meaning given to the overuse of long words. Or it can mean long and ponderous, polysyllabic. You can refer to a pretentious professor who just loves to try and impress others with lots of big, fancy, schmancy words as sesquipedalian. So let's put sesquipedalian in context. During his class presentation, the student tried to disguise his complete lack of understanding with sesquipedalian words. The teacher wasn't fooled. Now, according to John Ayto's Dictionary of Word Origins, sesquipedalian was an English word inspired by Horace, the Roman poet. Horace criticized the pretentious use of long, pompous-sounding words, using the phrase sesquipedalia verba, literally words a foot and a half long. Isn't that great? Sesquipedalian comes from sesqua and ped. The Latin prefix sesqui means half as much again. And where else have you heard the prefix sesqua before? How about sesquicentennial? If a centennial anniversary celebrates 100 years, what does a sesquicentennial celebrate? You've got it. A centennial and a half, or 150 years. So to sum up, sesqua means half as much again. And the ped in sesquipedalian means foot, as in pedal, pedicure, and centipede. So sesquipedalian words look like they are a foot and a half long. So I want you to visualize yourself right now with measuring tape, measuring how long anti-disestablishmentarianism is. When you first try and read that one, it sure seems like it's a foot and a half long. And that's a great visual for your vocabulary notebook. And if all else fails and you encounter the word sesquipedalian again in a year and you can't remember it, just look at how long it is. Sesquipedalian is a sesquipedalian word, a long word to describe other long words. All right, let's move on from really long words to our final target word, which is only pretty long, somniloquy. And for this word, I think of a story involving my son, Jack. Now, Jack, like many teenagers, is a night owl. He just starts getting rolling about 9 p.m. So one night, we found him up past midnight, still doing his homework. The next day, my wife and I kept on him about how he can't be up past midnight. That midnight was just way too late for a school night. That midnight was a ridiculous hour. That he'd just have to get his homework done earlier so he could get to bed before midnight. Well, our midnight speech must have sunk in, because the next night I popped in his room to see if he had gone to bed yet. And when I opened the door, he bolted upright, eyes still closed, and started mumbling in his sleep in garbled language. And all I could understand was one word out of every three or four, the same word over and over again. And it sounded like this. Midnight, 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 can we go midnight? Jack's midnight jibber jabber has become legendary in our family lore, and it also brings us to our next target word, somniloquy. Somniloquy is a noun that means sleep talking. Now, somniloquy is an easy word to remember if we break it down by its morphemes, somna and L-O-Q. The root somna is from the Latin word somnus, which means sleep. We see the same root in the word insomnia, not being able to sleep. And the root spelled L-O-C or L-O-Q comes from the Latin verb loquor, which means to speak. We saw the same root in our target word obloquy from an earlier lecture. And remember, obloquy means critical speech or verbal abuse. Okay, so highlight these two word parts. Somni equals sleep, and L-O-Q equals speak, to remember that somniloquy means sleep talking. Well, I hope that I haven't put you to sleep today. But if you're given to somniloquy, I hope you'll try and include some of today's target words in your next late night monologue. English has a host of wonderful words to describe other wonderful words. And until next time, that's the last word.
Lecture 28, Specialty Words for Language.
Welcome back to part 2 in our lecture series on words for words. Today, we'll be exploring 9 words that refer to categories of vocabulary and language. Now, over the years, linguists and language scholars have organized and categorized words in a number of different ways. In this lecture, we'll discuss many of these linguistic categories, or specialty words, such as blended words, clipped words, and one of my favorites, spoonerisms. So, let's start with spoonerism. Spoonerism is a noun referring to the transposition of usually the initial sounds of two or more words, often creating a humorous effect. Spoonerisms are most often slips of the tongue or speech errors, but are sometimes made intentionally for comedy's sake. For example, one might mistakenly say, "Go and shake a tower," instead of the intended, "Go and take a shower," or "a well-boiled icicle," instead of "a well-oiled bicycle." These are two examples that were actually attributed to the man spoonerism was named after, the Reverend William Archibald Spooner. So, spoonerism is an eponym, as well as being a word category. Spooner was an Anglican clergyman and warden of New College, Oxford, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He was a well-respected, kindly man, but is known in history for his humorous slips of the tongue. Now, while Spooner undoubtedly had a penchant for his muddled speech and hilarious airs, many spoonerisms attributed to him are apocryphal. But legitimate or not, here are some other well-known spoonerisms attributed to Spooner himself. "The Lord is a shoving leopard," instead of "the Lord is a loving shepherd." "It is customary to cuss the bride," instead of "it is customary to kiss the bride." "Let us glaze our rasses to the queer old dean," instead of "let us raise our glasses to the dear old queen." "Is the bean dizzy?" instead of "is the dean busy?" And "he was killed by a blushing crow," instead of "he was killed by a crushing blow." Now, we all have these slips of the tongue from time to time. But as David Crystal notes in the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language, the interesting thing about them is that they are predictable. They're not random. One predictable pattern of spoonerisms is that the two words that contain the slip of the tongue, like blushing crow for crushing blow, are usually found within the same syntactic or rhythm unit, often right next to each other. So, you're more likely to swap sounds in two words that are in the same phrase, not words found far apart. So, spoonerisms give us some insight into how our minds plan out our speech. We plan our speech into phrasal units, and these phrases correspond to units of thought. When we try to lay down the spoken words that represent these units of thought, putting the meat on the skeleton of the phrase, we sometimes put them down in the wrong places, mixing up words and sounds within the words. Okay, let's move on from spoonerisms to our next 3 target words, 3 H words, homophones, homographs, and homonyms. While you've probably heard of all 3 of these words before, I find that many people confuse their meanings. And moreover, different sources define these 3 words differently. So I'm going to use the definitions that we use in literacy education with our students. And for our definitions, it's helpful to know that up front, these H words differ across 3 important features: sound, spelling, and meaning. Okay, let's start with homophones. A homophone is a noun referring to one of 2 or more words that sound the same but are spelled differently and have different meanings. Now, you can remember homophone because the Greek root H-O-M-O means same, and the root spelled P-H-O-N means sound, as in phonics or telephone. So, homophones are same-sounding words. I'm going to read a list of homophone pairs, and I want you to notice how each pair sounds the same. In fact, you won't know which homophone is which when I say them. You'll have to wait until I spell them or tell you their meaning. You ready? Here we go. Blue and blue. Blue as in the color, B-L-U-E, and blue as in what the wind did, B-L-E-W. Faint and faint. Faint as in to get dizzy, F-A-I-N-T, and faint as in to fake a movement, go one way and then go another, F-E-I-N-T. Here are a few other homophones. Haul and haul. Haul as in to haul a load of wood, and haul as in an entrance hall. And we have homophones in English of more than one syllable, like patience and patience. A doctor should have patience with her patients. And colonel and colonel. The army colonel liked to pop kernels of popcorn. So to sum up, homophones are words that sound the same but have different spellings and meanings. Now let's move from homophones to homographs, from sound to spelling. Now the root graph is from the Greek word grapho, which means to write. Think of the graphite in a pencil that writes, or your autograph, the signature that you write. So a homograph is a noun referring to one of two or more words that are written or spelled the same, but have different pronunciations and meanings. For our homograph activity, I'm going to spell a word. And because homographs are words that are spelled the same, you won't know which word of the homograph pair that I'm referring to. So when I spell the word, I want to see if you can pull up both meanings and both pronunciations of the word in your mind. You ready? Okay, here we go. This homograph is spelled B-A-S-S. Now, which two words come to your mind? How about the fish, bass, and the large stringed instrument, a bass? Okay, now that you've got the hang of it, let's try another. This homograph is spelled B-O-W. What two words come to your mind? How about the stringed weapon that shoots arrows, a bow, and the verb meaning to bend in respect, to bow? All right, let's try one more homograph. This homograph is spelled M I-N-U-T-E. What two words come to mind? 60 seconds equals 1 minute, and something that is very small is minute. Minute and minute. So, to recap what we've learned so far, homophones have the same sound, but different spellings and meanings. Blue and blue. Homographs have the same spelling, but different sounds and meanings. Bass and bass. Our final H word in this category is homonym. An easy way to remember homonyms is that they have characteristics of both homographs and homophones. In other words, a homonym is a noun referring to one of two or more words that are spelled the same and pronounced the same, but carry different meanings. An example of a homonym pair is bear and bear. Now, both words are spelled the same, B-E-A-R, and pronounced the same, but have two very different meanings. You've got the big furry animal, a bear, and then you have the verb bear, as in to bear a burden. Now, we also call homonyms multiple meaning words, because from its spelling, a homonym looks and sounds like one word, but it's actually two different words with different meanings. You can remember the term homonym from its word elements. Now, we already know that H-O-M-O means same. When we learned about eponyms, we also learned that O-N-Y-M is from the Greek word onuma, meaning name. So homonyms are words that have the same name, the same spelling and sound, even though they have different meanings. Because homonyms are spelled the same and sound the same, only way to know which word a writer or speaker means is from its context. In this next homonym activity, I'll introduce a few words. I'll pronounce them. See if you can quickly identify two meanings for each word. Box. Box, the container that you store things in, and box meaning to fight. Fire. You can fire the employees for starting a fire in the building. And pitcher. The pitcher on the baseball team was so thirsty, he gulped down a pitcher of water. So why does English have word pairs that are spelled the same and sound the same, but mean different things? I mean, doesn't this get confusing? Well, it's often because these homonyms are actually two different words derived from two different sources and just happen to have evolved into the same spelling and pronunciation. Now, we've already met a very specific category of homonyms in an earlier lecture, Janus words. Now, if you remember, Janus words, or contronyms, are homonym pairs in which one word in the pair is the antonym for the other word in the pair. For example, do you remember our target word from an earlier lecture, cleave, which can mean to split or divide by cutting? Or it can mean the exact opposite, to cling closely to. I mean, one word that means both to split apart and to cling to. Yes, English can seem crazy at times. Now, if you remember, Janus words got their name from the Roman god Janus, the two-faced god of gates, doorways, and beginnings and endings. A god that faces opposite ways for words that have opposite meanings. Here are a few other Janus words. Sanction. Sanction can mean both to permit someone to do something and to punish or penalize. For example, you can sanction someone to do something as in the town sanctioned the use of motor scooters on sidewalks. Or sanction can carry the meaning of a penalty or a punishment as in the U.S. imposed economic sanctions against Russia. And even that simple dirty word dust is a Janus word. I mean, dust can mean both to remove dust and to add dust. You can dust the house in which you're doing what? You're removing dust. Or you can dust a cake when you're adding powdered sugar by sprinkling it on. Now that we're done with the H words, let's move to another category, the nyms. We'll be discussing the three following target words, eponyms, toponyms, and acronyms. Now, as we reminded ourselves a moment ago, the suffix O-N-Y-M means name or word, and these nyms are all based on different types of names. Now, we've already had an entire lecture on eponyms. An eponym is a noun referring to a word derived from a person's name. Remember that draconian was named after the harsh Greek lawgiver Draco, and quixotic was named after the romantically idealistic Don Quixote. So, I'd like to make one brief but important point about eponyms, and then share just a few more. There's a bit of a confusion over the meaning of the word eponym. You may see it defined as one whose name is or is thought to be the source of something. Let's use the word bowdlerize, one of our eponyms from a previous lecture, as an example. Now, if you remember, bowdlerize meant to change a text by modifying or deleting parts that might be considered vulgar. And bowdlerize was named after who? Thomas Bowdler, the physician who published a sanitized version of Shakespeare's works. So if we use this definition of eponym, it's the source, which is actually the eponym for the derived word bowdlerize. However, we're defining eponym in this course as the word or name derived from a proper noun. And using this definition, bowdlerize is the eponym derived from the original name, bowdler. So here are a few more wonderful eponyms that you already know. However, you may not be aware of the person and the story behind the word. First one, boycott. Now, boycott means to abstain from buying or using something, and is actually named after Charles Boycott, the land manager for an absentee landlord in County Mayo, Ireland. Now, Boycott refused to lower rents to Irish tenant farmers in 1880, which was actually a poor year for harvests. Now, these tenant farmers were not a bunch of pushovers. They decided to act. In response, the locals organized a campaign to shun Boycott, refusing to have anything to do with him. boycotts workers refused to harvest his crops. Businessmen would not even trade with him. Even the local postman would not deliver his mail. I mean, ouch. Talk about a lonely guy. This type of protest and the word itself quickly spread across Europe and even into non-European languages. Our next eponym, guillotine. Now, when you hear this word, you might cringe and feel your hair standing up on the back of your neck. But believe it or not, guillotines were actually developed as a more humane way of executing people. Huh? Well, according to the Merriam-Webster New Book of Word Histories, before the guillotine, there were two primary methods of execution. You ready for this? For the common criminal, hanging. And for the nobility and the rest of the blue bloods, decapitation by broadaxe. I mean, how is decapitation better than hanging? Well, it was supposedly a quicker death than hanging. However, if your executioner wasn't too skilled, or he'd had a few too many swigs from the wine bottle, it could make for a messy, ugly death. So with the French Revolution leading to an increase in executions, Joseph Ignace Guillotin, a French physician, proposed that a machine could deliver a more humane form of execution. And the actual inventor of the guillotine was actually not Guillotin himself, but Tobias Schmidt, a German mechanic. And before trying out the machine on living people, Schmidt did a test run with corpses from the hospital. And finally, let's move from executions to a more refined topic for our last eponym, proper manners and behavior. Grundyism. Grundyism is a prudish adherence to conventionality, especially in personal behavior, a display of excessive modesty. Now, this word doesn't come from an actual person, but from an unseen character in Speed the Plow, a 1798 play by Thomas Morton. And Mrs. Grundy was known for her extremely over-the-top prudishness, particularly in matters of sexual morality. And another character in the play, Dame Ashfield, when figuring out how to respond to a moral dilemma, would ask herself, "What would Mrs. Grundy say?" So this question, along with the persona of Mrs. Grundy herself, became well established in the public and in literature as an example of over-the-top prudishness. Okay, let's move from eponyms, words named after people, to our next nym category, toponyms. Now, the T-O-P in toponym comes from the Greek word topos, meaning place. You find the same root in words like topography. Now, the general meaning of toponym is just a place name, like New York or London. However, we're focusing on toponym's second meaning. A toponym is a noun referring to a word named after a place. Now, we've already encountered a few toponyms in our lectures, including Billingsgate. Do you remember Billingsgate? It's that vulgar speech named after the market at Billingsgate in London, where the female fishmongers spewed forth harsh, but quite creative, profanity. Now here's another toponym with a fantastic history. Tuxedo. Tuxedo originally came from a native Delaware word that meant wolf. This word was anglicized and given to the name of Tuxedo Village in southeastern New York. Tuxedo Park, on Tuxedo Lake, and near the village of Tuxedo, developed into a swanky and fashionable resort for the hoity-toity in the 1880s. And by the turn of the century, a few of the young bucks had become disenchanted with the current style of formal dress that was in fashion. And as young folks do, they started a new fashion trend, wearing dress jackets, are you ready for this, without any tails. Thus, the tuxedo was born. And you could eat an entire meal consisting solely of culinary toponyms, foods named after places. I mean, for the main meal, you'd have your choice of frankfurters or hamburgers, named after Frankfurt and Hamburg, Germany, respectively. For your condiments, you could choose either Worcestershire sauce from England or Dijon mustard from Dijon, France. And for a delicious side, you'd have Boston baked beans. If you prefer wine, you could have a nice Bordeaux, named after the French region of the same name. Or if you want something a little bit stronger, you could sip a Manhattan, an Alabama Slammer, a Long Island iced tea, a Lynchburg lemonade, or a Singapore sling. And now let's move from eponyms and toponyms to our last nym, acronyms. Acronyms are one way that English speakers economize their language. An acronym is a noun referring to a word or abbreviation formed from the initial letters of each of the successive or major parts of a compound term. Acronyms are created by taking the initial letters of a set of words and combining them into a single word or phrase. Now, acro comes from the Greek word akros, which means topmost or highest, but can also refer to the tip of something. So, think of an acronym as consisting of the tips of several words. For example, NATO is an acronym for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. How about USA, FBI, and CIA? Now, because we pronounce them as a series of initial letters rather than a whole word like NATO, some linguists classify them as initialisms, not acronyms. However, we're going to discuss them all together here. Now, we think of acronyms as a recent phenomenon because the term acronym came into English in the 1940s. And there has been a dramatic increase in acronym usage in the 20th century. However, acronyms are by no means a modern invention. For example, if you lived in ancient Rome and encountered a Roman legion on the march, you'd see the acronym SPQR emblazoned on their standards. SPQR stands for the Latin phrase Senatus Populus Quae Romanus, which translated means the Senate and the people of Rome. It was a way of referring to the government of the Roman Republic and later of the Roman Empire. Now, the following acronyms all have the initial letters of the set of words making up a new word that is pronounced as a whole word, such as radar for radio detection and ranging, scuba for self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, and laser for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Now, the military is known far and wide for its penchant for acronyms. In fact, thanks to all those acronyms, military jargon can seem like an entire language unto itself. Now, here are two military acronyms that display a soldier's sense of humor and their resignation that things don't always go as planned in the fog of war. I'll be bowdlerizing these acronyms, inserting the word FOUL for the actual F word that soldiers use. Our first word is snafu. Situation normal, all fouled up. Snafu seems to have originated with the U.S. military during World War II to convey the soldier's acceptance of the fog of war and the ineptitude of his commanders. This is a great word to use when you're experiencing a similar type of problem again and again, or the same problem from the same person or group. We're working through another snafu created by our illustrious boss. And then, FUBAR, fouled up beyond all recognition. FUBAR is another acronym originating with the U.S. military in World War II. Use FUBAR when things have really gotten out of hand. So, acronyms like SCUBA, SNAFU, and FUBAR are one way we economize English, saying more with less. Now, another way we do this is by using our next target word, portmanteau words, also known as blended words. And we've encountered a number of portmanteau words in earlier lectures, like gerrymander, combined from the Massachusetts governor, Elbridge Gerry, and a salamander. So gerrymander is actually a portmanteau word and an eponym. Now, as a quick refresher, a portmanteau word is a noun referring to a new word that is blended together from the existing parts of other words. This type of blending is a wonderfully useful and fun word formation process. Now, as a relatively recent example, infomercial comes from information and commercial. Or how about netiquette, which is a blending of internet and etiquette? And how about one of my favorite portmanteau words, chortle? A combination of chuckle and snort. And it was Lewis Carroll himself, the famed author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, who first used the term portmanteau to classify certain kinds of words. In his sequel, Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There, Humpty Dumpty is explaining to Alice the unusual terms in the nonsense poem Jabberwocky, like mimsy, a combination of miserable and flimsy. Humpty Dumpty explains how these strange words came to be, saying, "You see, it's like a portmanteau. There are two meanings packed up into one word." So what exactly is a portmanteau? Well, the word portmanteau comes from the two French words, porte, meaning to carry, and manteau, meaning cloak. And a portmanteau is a suitcase or bag with two compartments that can be folded together. And I remember as a kid, I had a suitcase like this with two compartments. Even though I neatly packed my underwear and lighter clothes on one side, and my sweatshirts and heavier clothes on the other side, when we got to our destination, I opened up my suitcase. My clothes were inevitably all mixed up, all blended together. Just like portmanteau words. Two words that are blended together to form a new word. Here are some other portmanteau words. Motel comes from motor and hotel. And brunch comes from breakfast and lunch. And a spork can be both a spoon and a fork. And a turducken is a chicken stuffed inside a duck, which is stuffed inside a turkey. I mean, how's that for a meat lover? And stagflation came from stagnation and inflation. We even use the portmanteau process to refer to a pair of people that the public views as a single persona, such as Billary for Bill and Hillary Clinton, and Brangelina for celebrity couples like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And the names of some companies and organizations are portmanteau words, like Microsoft from microcomputer and software, and even Amtrak from American and track. So acronyms and portmanteau words are two ways we say more with less in English. And that brings us to a third way English economizes, and our final target word for this lecture, clipped words. Clipped words are just that. A part of the word is clipped off to shorten it. More formally, a clipped word is a noun referring to a word that has been shortened with no change in its meaning. For example, you might hear someone say, "I'm going to the gym." Gym is actually a clipped word coming from the longer word, gymnasium. Here are some other common clipped words where the ending has been clipped off. Exam is a shortened form of examination. Lab is a clipped word from laboratory. And you can also clip the beginning of a word off, as in cockroach clipped to roach. And internet clipped to net. And you can even clip the middle of a word off, as in influenza shortened to flu. And refrigerator shortened to fridge. And let's finish the lecture with the story behind my favorite clipped word of all time, canter, referring to a horse's easy gallop. Well, canter's story starts all the way back in England in 1170. In that momentous year, Thomas à Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, was murdered in Canterbury Cathedral by four knights from the court of King Henry II. And within just a few years, Thomas, now viewed as a religious martyr, was canonized as St. Thomas à Becket, and a shrine was established to him in a chapel of the cathedral. Now pilgrims began flocking to his shrine. Remember Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? And according to the Dictionary of Word Origins, because many of these pilgrims traveled to Canterbury on horseback, the supposed pace at which these pilgrims rode into town came to be called the Canterbury Trot, or gallop. And by the 18th century, Canterbury Trot had been shortened to canter. Wow. From a murder in a cathedral, to a saint, to a pilgrimage, to a term for a horse's gait. I mean, isn't English a wonderful thing? Now, as you canter away from this lecture, and as we near the end of this course, I hope you continue to learn more vocabulary. And as you do, be on the lookout for eponyms, portmanteau words, and all the other fantastic word categories that we discussed today. And to me, these aren't just categories of words for linguists to study. They are proof of the creative power of English to create new words as we need them.
Lecture 29, Nasty Words and Nice Words.
Hello. Today's lecture is focused on words related to nasty and nice. Now, as you know, nasty can mean offensive and vicious, like a nasty Doberman pincher. And nice means pleasing, agreeable, and delightful, like a nice little kitten. Right? Not so fast. Nice hasn't always been so nice. Nice originally comes from the Latin nescius, which means ignorant and unaware. Now just think, from ignorant and unaware centuries ago to pleasing and agreeable today. I mean, how in the world did nice get from there to here? Well, it turns out that it's been a long, strange trip for nice. According to the Merriam-Webster New Book of Word Histories, the Latin word nescius made its way into Old French, from which English borrowed nice in the late 13th century. At this time, the English word nice actually meant foolish, stupid, and senseless. Nice then took on many meanings over the years, including, now get this, wanton and lascivious in the 14th century, coy and reserved in the 15th century, and precise, careful, and delicate in the 16th century. This sense of precise and careful is still preserved today in the phrase, a nice distinction. And it wasn't until the 18th century that nice began to be used in the modern sense of agreeable and pleasing. And nice has become the bane of existence to many middle and high school English teachers that I know, who read student essays riddled with the word nice. Now, this glut of niceness isn't just a modern problem. It's been going on at least since the era of Jane Austen. So let's listen to two characters in Jane Austen's 1803 novel, Northanger Abbey, discussing the word nice. "I am sure," cried Catherine, "I did not mean to say anything wrong, but it is a very nice book, and why should I not call it so?" "Very true," said Henry, "and this is a very nice day, and we're taking a very nice walk, and you are two very nice young ladies. Oh, it is a very nice word indeed. It does for everything." And I think many of us are guilty, myself included, of maybe overusing the word nice. So let's dive right in to some other words we can use instead of nice and nasty. After all, variety is the spice of life. So for our first target word, I'm going to take you all the way back in history to the Middle Ages, to October 1347 at the Sicilian port of Messina. Now, on that day, the townspeople had all come to the docks to greet 12 trading ships. However, they were in for a terrible surprise that would forever change the course of history. And what they found is like the scene from a modern-day horror movie. Nearly all the sailors aboard the ships were dead, and the few that were alive were in terrible pain, riddled with fever and vomiting. And perhaps most horrifying were the strange black boils oozing pus and blood that covered the sailors and eventually gave rise to the name the Black Death. The Black Death was so infectious and deadly that you could be the picture of health when you went to bed and dead by the next morning. And it wasn't just the strange black boils, which started on the groin or under the armpits and then spread, growing as big as an egg or even an apple. Those who were infected experienced other awful symptoms, including chills, fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and excruciating pain. Some historians estimate that one-third of Europe's population, 20 million people, died from the Black Death in 5 years following the introduction of the disease in Sicily in 1347. So the Black Death is a perfectly horrifying example of our first nasty target word, virulent. Virulent is an adjective that carries two meanings. First, virulent can mean extremely infectious, malignant, poisonous, or deadly. In this first literal sense, you'll hear of virulent diseases like the Black Death. Remember, virulent diseases aren't just any old disease like chickenpox. Oh no, virulent diseases are highly infectious, particularly malignant, nasty diseases that spread rapidly and are very hard to stop. But there is a second, more figurative meaning of virulent. Bitterly hostile, antagonistic, or spiteful, hateful. In this second sense, you might hear or read of a virulent personal attack, which could be a particularly spiteful and bitter verbal barrage. Now, when you look at the word virulent, V-I-R-U-L-E-N-T, do any related words come to your mind? What other words do you already know that look the same? If you said virus, you're correct. Virulent is related to the English word virus, which comes from a Latin word meaning poison. So to remember virulent, highlight the V-I-R-U and connect it to virus and poisonous. A virus is infectious and poisonous to people, the first meaning of virulent. And a virulent attack is poisonous and deadly in a figurative sense. You'll hear the synonyms of related words like acerbic, caustic, acrimonious, and vitriolic. Okay, we have a usage alert here. You might be wondering if virulent is related to virile. It isn't. Even though they share the same first three letters, the two words do not share the same origin. Virile means masculine, characterized by strength, energy, vigor, and power. It comes from the Latin vir, meaning man. Okay, for our next target word, pernicious. I think of the first time that I smoked a cigarette. I was 7 years old. Now, my dad had just quit smoking. He told us that he never wanted us to start because of how hard it was for him to quit and how harmful it could be to our health. He went through a whole litany of ailments that smoking could cause. But he knew we would be curious, so he decided to nip our curiosity in the bud. And what better way than to let us take a bite or a whiff of the forbidden fruit ourselves? So, my dad took my brother Colin and me out on our back porch and lit an unfiltered Camel. I put my lips around the cigarette and sucked in for all I was worth. Immediately, my eyes began to water, I started coughing, and I spent all day trying to get the taste out of my mouth. My dad's old school pedagogy worked. I've never wanted to smoke a cigarette since. Which brings me to our next target word, pernicious. Pernicious is an adjective meaning exceedingly harmful or destructive, deadly. That day, my dad warned us of the pernicious effects of smoking. Pernicious often implies something that is working in a hidden, insidious way, like a pernicious disease. You might hear of the pernicious effects of a new government policy, or the pernicious influence of gratuitous TV violence on young people. So in your vocabulary notebook, write down an example of something that's pernicious in your life. Perhaps it's a harmful disease that's affected someone that you know, or rumors that have really hurt a classmate or a friend. Okay, that's two pretty unpleasant words so far, virulent and pernicious. Mordant, our next target word, is unpleasant in a different way. So what do you think mordant means? Do you think mordant means dying or bitingly sarcastic? See if the sentence helps. The comedian's mordant humor, while incisive, made the audience uncomfortable. So if you said the second answer, you were right. Mordant is an adjective meaning bitingly sarcastic. For mordant, I think of someone I used to work with. She was really smart, but she had a razor-sharp tongue that she used to make cutting, sarcastic remarks. Other people actually walked away when they saw her coming because her remarks were often a bit malicious. Do you know someone like this? Someone who is bitingly sarcastic? Then you know someone with a mordant wit. So use mordant to emphasize the biting, sarcastic nature of the language. Someone who's mordant has the ability to drive home disagreeable truths in a sardonic, caustic manner. Mordant comments imply insensitivity or even outright maliciousness in the intent. Now, synonyms and closely related words for mordant include caustic, acrid, and scathing. Caustic is a close synonym for mordant. Now, use acrid when you want to stress bitterness and even malevolence. Scathing often implies righteous indignation and can describe a withering criticism and a fierce raking over the coals. For example, you might see a scathing exposé of a politician's corrupt administration by an investigative reporter on the news. So, a scathing criticism, while fierce, can come from a good motive. That's different than a mordant criticism, which often implies ill intent. Okay, mordant originally came from the Latin mordeo, meaning to bite into, nip, sting. And mordant is related to the English word morsel, a small bite of something. That's a wonderful visual, isn't it? In fact, let's make use of it in our vocabulary notebook. So highlight the M-O-R in mordant and connect it to the word morsel, a bite. Mordant, morsel. Draw a picture of a mouth biting a morsel of something with sharp teeth. And this will remind you that a mordant comment is biting and sharp. It hurts because it cuts. And here's an interesting connection. Remorse, a deep and painful regret for a past wrongdoing, is another word that comes from the same Latin origin. We know that the prefix re, re, can mean back, and more means bite. So, a feeling of remorse is literally a feeling of something you did in the past coming back to bite you. Okay, we have another usage alert here. Don't confuse the Latin root commonly spelled M-O-R-D or M-O-R, meaning to bite, with the Latin root M-O-R-T, which means death. The words mordant, morsel, and remorse are all connected, but they have no etymological relationship with mort, words like mortuary, immortal, and mortality. Okay, so mordant connotes sharp and biting. However, can something be sharp and biting but in a nice way? Well, this brings us to our next target word, one of Flanagan's favorites, and one I think is underused, piquant. Now, piquant is an adjective that has three related meanings. First, piquant can mean agreeably pungent or sharp in taste or flavor, pleasantly biting or tart, spicy. Now, when I think of this sense of piquant, I think of my son's first taste of lemons at the age of 2. Now, Jack was in our kitchen, and he kept pointing to and asking what the small yellow fruit on the counter was. So I said, a lemon. From that point on, he kept pointing, saying, lemon, lemon, lemon. He wanted to taste that lemon, and he just wouldn't give up. So finally, I gave him a lemon wedge to suck on, thinking this would surely cure his curiosity once and for all. I mean, the tartness would be way too much for him. And after a quick taste, he'd get all puckered up and never want to taste again. But that's not what happened. Jack took his first suck on the lemon wedge, made a quick startled look with his eyebrows raised, and then, deciding the lemon had a surprisingly pleasant and strong taste, continued sucking on that lemon and kept it up all morning. We couldn't pry that lemon away from him. A few hours later, he'd sucked all the zest, juice, and flesh out of it, leaving only the lemon rind. Now, to other kids, that lemon might have been too tart. But to Jack, it was piquant, agreeably tart and pungent. And to this day, Jack still loves all things sour. Now, piquant can also mean agreeably stimulating and engagingly provocative, as in, Jack, our son, has actually grown into a very smart teenager whose piquant questions and commentary spark rich conversations in our family. Or, piquant can mean interesting, charming, or attractive, as in, her piquant wit. Now, antonyms for piquant are bland, tasteless, and one of our target words from an earlier lecture, insipid. So, piquant comes from the French word pique, meaning to prick or sting, and is related to the English word pike. So to remember piquant, connect it to the word pick, a small toothpick that you can poke someone with. It wakes them up. It's engagingly provocative. And this will help you remember that piquant things prick and sting, but in a good way. So make a personal connection to piquant. Think of a food you eat that's piquant, that's pleasantly sharp and pungent, like your aunt's homemade spicy salsa. Write this piquant food or drink down in your vocabulary notebook. Or make a personal connection to piquant in its more figurative sense, something or someone that's engagingly provocative and lively, in a good way. I think of the guys in my book club group. We come to our group with some provocative, engaging questions to stir the pot and get a lively, engaging, and piquant conversation going. It's stimulating and provocative all at the same time. That's piquant. And if you were wondering, piquant and pique both share the same French ancestor word meaning to prick or sting. So it's no surprise that pique used as a verb means to irritate or provoke. When something pricks you, you're going to be provoked. You might also hear the phrase, it piqued my interest, meaning it aroused or stimulated your curiosity. Okay, now that we're halfway through our lecture, let's review our first four words. Three downright nasty words, virulent, pernicious, and mordant, and a fourth word, piquant, a word that's pleasantly biting. Okay, situation one. You're a college student in a debate class, and your team has just finished its opening argument. Now, Eric on the opposing team is making his argument, and Eric's comments are caustic and bitingly sarcastic. Are Eric's comments best described as pernicious or mordant? Eric's comments are best described as mordant, which carries the connotation of bitterness and ill intent. Okay, situation two. You're hanging out at a local coffee shop, noshing on some incredibly sharp provolone cheese that makes you sit up and take notice. It's pungent, a bit strong, but you like it. Just when you're about to take another nibble, one of the regulars start asking some questions that spark a lively debate. Everyone starts putting their two cents in. It's an engaging, provocative give and take, but you don't detect any hard feelings. Everyone's enjoying this back and forth. Which could be considered piquant? The cheese or the debate? Answer? Sorry, it's a trick question. Both could be considered piquant. The cheese is pleasantly sharp and biting. That's one sense of piquant. And the debate is engagingly provocative. That's another sense of piquant. Okay, situation three. A couple is sitting across from you at the local diner. They get into a mild tiff, voices are slightly raised, and they quickly leave without talking to one another. Is this an example of a virulent argument? Answer? No. A virulent argument is spiteful, hateful, and bitterly antagonistic. If it were virulent, you probably would have heard some harsh language, possibly would have seen a salt shaker thrown, and definitely would have seen the couple leave separately. Okay, let's move on from our midpoint review to our next target word, officious. Now, what do you think officious means? Do you think officious has anything to do with official, like someone operating in an official capacity? Or do you think officious is related to office? Well, officious is related to office, but perhaps not quite in the way you might think. So for officious, I want you to think of the type of person we've probably all encountered or worked with at one point in our lives, the office busybody. Now, you know who I'm talking about. This is the person who's always giving advice, even when it's not wanted. An officious person will come over to your desk and tell you how to write your report. And at a meeting, the officious people are the ones who are always throwing in their two cents, offering their opinions on every subject that comes up, even when it doesn't concern them. They're so eager to do more than their job that they've crossed the line from helpful to annoying and meddlesome. These interfering busybodies are officious. Officious is an adjective meaning marked by excessive, often aggressive eagerness in offering unwanted advice, service, or help to others. Meddlesome. Officious people come across as high-handed and overbearing, pushy, and overzealous. So let's put officious in context. The officious waiter practically ordered our meal for us, telling us what to eat, what to drink, and even explaining how we should eat it. I mean, it was too much. So, how is officious related to office? Well, both words come from the Latin officium, meaning duty or service. According to the Online Etymology Dictionary, when officious originally came into English in the 1560s, it carried the positive meaning of zealous, eager to serve. Okay, that's a good thing, right? I mean, you want someone at work who is excited and eager to do their job. However, it only took about 40 years by 1600 for officious to take on its current negative connotation, meaning overzealous, meddlesome, too eager to serve. So to remember officious, highlight the O-F-F-I-C and write the related word office. And highlight the O-U-S suffix meaning full of. So someone who is officious could be full of their job at the office. They're so eager to do their duty to serve others that they come across as pushy and annoying. And make a personal connection to officious. Who do you know who tries to be so helpful that they cross the line to annoying and pushy? A parent? An in-law? A neighbor or a roommate? Write this person's name down. And duck for cover when this officious person comes around to help. Whew, okay, we've been tending toward the nastier side of life so far in the lecture. So let's wash off all the filth and move on from the biting remarks of the mordant, the poisonous, spiteful comments of the virulent, and those pushy, overbearing, officious meddlers. Let's go find some nicer, kinder, gentler words, like our next two target words that we'll explore as a pair, salubrious and salutary. I mean, they even sound a whole lot nicer, don't they? Just say them with me. Salubrious and salutary. They sound like a breath of fresh air, healthy salt air blowing in from the ocean. Now, you've probably heard and seen salubrious and salutary before, and you may have some idea that they're pretty close in meaning. They can both describe something that is good for your health. However, one of these two is more often used to describe something that's beneficial in a more general sense. So which is which? Okay, so listen to this sentence with salubrious in context and see if it helps. The salubrious air of the seashore with its salty tang always seemed to make me feel a whole lot healthier. So as you can see from this context, salubrious is an adjective meaning conducive or favorable to your health or well-being, wholesome. And you may encounter its antonym, insalubrious. In is a prefix that means not. So insalubrious means unhealthy, unwholesome. Now to remember salubrious, connect it to something in your life that promotes your well-being. Perhaps like joining a gym, eating those 5 servings of vegetables per day, or meditating. Those are salubrious undertakings. And what about the related word salutary? What's the same and what's different? Well, like salubrious, salutary is an adjective that can also mean favorable to your health. However, salutary is often used to describe a more general improvement in something. In this sense, we'll define salutary as an adjective meaning producing a beneficial effect, remedial. Now, according to The Artful Nuance by Rod L. Evans, what is salutary promotes an improvement, especially an educational, a psychological, or a moral one. Okay, so you'll often hear salutary used alongside its collocates, effect or effects, in a sentence like, research has proven that unstructured play has a salutary effect on children's social and emotional development. Now, as you can infer from the S-A-L-U morpheme, both salubrious and salutary come from the same root. Let's use the related word strategy. Is there another word you already know that looks similar in spelling to salubrious and salutary? If you said salute or salutation, you're right. Salutary, salubrious, salute, and salutation all contain the root S-A-L-U, which is found in several Latin words relating to health and welfare. I mean, so what's a salutation? It's a greeting like, Dear Kevin. And when you greet someone, the first thing you want to know is how they're doing, including their health. When the ancient Romans greeted one another, they typically said, Salve, which literally means, be well. And a military salute is a formal greeting. When you toast someone, you're saluting them informally, wishing them good health. In French, a more informal way to greet your friends is to say, salut. And since we're on the subject of toasts, my wife is Danish, so we can't forget skål, S-K-O-A-L. Skål is a Scandinavian toasting word that comes from the Danish skål, meaning toast, or literally bowl, cup, originally a cup made from a shell. And in Irish, a common toast is slánte, also meaning health. Okay, let's keep on keeping on with these nice words like salutary and salubrious. Our next nice target word and our final word of the day is avuncular. Now, avuncular is an adjective carrying two meanings. One, of or having to do with an uncle. And two, resembling an uncle. Friendly, helpful, kind, patient, and indulgent. Now, for avuncular, I think of my great friend Bob, known to my children as Uncle Bob, even though he's not a true uncle by blood. Uncle Bob's like a great big teddy bear. He's 6'6", has a little bit of a bark when he gets ornery, but deep down he's just a big softy. Uncle Bob's always doing helpful stuff. Let me list a few of the ways Uncle Bob's been avuncular: helpful, friendly, patient, and indulgent. Now, when I was going to grad school, we had two children at the time, and we're living on a tight budget. We had to move 4 times in 3 years. It was hellacious. First, we moved to an apartment at the University of Virginia. Then, we moved from the apartment, which wasn't working out, to a rental house. Then, when I finished my coursework, we went from the rental house back to our original house. And finally, we moved to a new state to start a new job. And you know what? Bob was there for every single move, helping us lift every single stick of furniture. And Bob's always sending our kids gifts, particularly giving them stuff that we as parents won't. You know what I'm talking about. He'll take them out for ice cream, take them to their favorite restaurants, and has even taught them how to fish. When they were younger, he'd let them climb all over him. And here's our favorite example of Uncle Bob being avuncular. Now, Bob's got a pretty cheesy sense of humor that my kids love, but give him a hard time about. So my two daughters have dubbed him a cheese ball. So one time before a visit, Bob had a humongous canister of actual cheese balls, you know, the snack, delivered to our house. And Bob and our two girls proceeded to have a cheese ball fight in our front yard, pelting each other with cheese balls and calling each other cheese ball. Kind, friendly, patient, and indulgent, particularly with folks who are younger. That's Uncle Bob, and that's avuncular. Now, you'll often hear avuncular used not in the strict uncle sense, but in the more general patient and kind sense, in phrases like avuncular charm or avuncular indulgence. So let's put avuncular in context. The criminal was relieved when he found out that the avuncular Judge Beneficent would sentence him. He knew he would get a light sentence. Now, as you might imagine, with all this talk of uncles, avuncular comes from the Latin avunculus, meaning maternal uncle. And avunculus is, in fact, the ultimate source of our word, uncle. So to remember avuncular, in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the UNC in avuncular and link it to uncle. And pick your favorite uncle. You know, the one who's always giving you stuff that your parents wouldn't, slipping you bits of candy and dollar bills, and write something like, Uncle Bob is an avuncular uncle, kind, helpful, and patient. Okay, so let's quickly review our last four words: officious, salubrious and salutary, and avuncular. What's the meaning of the S-A-L-U root of both salubrious and salutary? Answer, the root denotes health and welfare. Okay, which word describes the interfering busybody who is too eager to help others with unwanted advice? Officious or pernicious? Answer, officious. Okay, which word describes a kind, friendly, patient, and indulgent person? Answer, avuncular. And with avuncular, we've come full circle. We started this lecture with the word nice, which wasn't as nice as we thought, proceeded through some nasty words, and have ended with a few nice ones again. Which is a good place to end up, don't you think? And I wish you a very, very, very nice day.
Lecture 30, Words for the Really Big and the Very Small.
I'd like to start this lecture on big and small vocabulary with a story about Big Bob, also known as Bobby Penn, Uncle Bobby to our kids, BP to his good friends, and BP legend to his golf buddies. I mean, Big Bob's a man so big, one nickname just isn't enough. Bob stands 6'6" and has a heart just as big to match. Now, I first met Bob in grad school. I barely knew him, but I'd found out that every single day, Bob was driving from his home 2 hours away to attend classes. And then every night, he'd turn right back around and drive 2 more hours to return home. Now, I had a small apartment at the time, so one day, I offered to let him crash on the floor whenever he wanted. And that very night, I heard a knock at the door. I opened the door, looked up, way up, and there was Bob. He crashed on my floor that night, and pretty much every night after that, and we became great friends. But one of the first things I remember about Bob was getting up that first morning that Bob crashed at my apartment and seeing Bob's huge, ginormous size 16 shoes sitting there on the floor. These shoes weren't just boats. They were ships. Okay, now, I tell you this story because this lecture focuses on words associated with literally big things, like Bob's shoes, and figuratively big things, like Bob's heart and giving personality. And along the way, we'll be answering a few of the following big and small questions. Is ginormous really a word in the dictionary? And if so, should I use it? And should really big things, like Big Bob's shoes, be described as capacious or commodious? And what's the difference between these two close synonyms? And on a different note, what are the two words the classic satire written by Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels, gave to English for big and small? Okay, let's dig in with our first big and small target word, exiguous. Exiguous. Now, do you think exiguous means A, extra, superfluous, more than is needed, or just the opposite, B, excessively scanty, inadequate, meager? Listen to exiguous in context to see if it helps. Starting with exiguous financial resources, she stunned everyone and made a fortune in the stock market, becoming known as a wizard of Wall Street. And the hungry boy tried to stretch out his exiguous lunch to make it last, chewing each bite 37 times. Now, from these examples, you can see that the answer is B. Exiguous is an adjective meaning excessively scanty, inadequate, and meager. Now, you can use exiguous to describe smallness in size, quantity, extent, or capacity. Synonyms for exiguous include inadequate, hand-to-mouth, scant, scarce, skimpy, spare, and sparse. Are you feeling a little deprived yet? Now, use exiguous to emphasize a smallness that is undesirable or is less than the normal amount or size of something. Now, you'll see exiguous used with its collocate, resources. So, what are exiguous resources? Resources that are not adequate, that are skimpy and meager. I mean, you might also encounter the phrases exiguous supplies or exiguous finances. And what about exiguous evidence? Would exiguous evidence be sufficient to convict someone of a crime? Probably not. Exiguous is one of those words you may not hear a lot in oral conversation, but are more likely to see in print. So, how can you remember it when you do encounter it? Okay, to remember exiguous, connect it to exact, a related word that comes from the same Latin origin. So, in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the EX and write down that when you have less than the exact